Unity. Unity. Brethren, there's been a call for national unity during the last few days. And the man that talked about it, he said, unity is one of the most elusive goals known to mankind. And I think we'd all agree with that. Unity is tough. Unity is tough. And yet, we know that unity is what we should be striving for. And how do we know it? Well, let's turn to Revelation 19. Revelation 19, verses 6 and 7. Some of my absolute favorite verses in the Bible, these two verses. Revelation 19, 6 to 7. And I heard, as it were, the voice of a great multitude, and the sound, as the sound of many waters, and as the sound of mighty thunderings, saying, Hallelujah, for the Lord God omnipotent reigns. Let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory. For the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his wife has made herself ready. That verse and that particular last phrase, his wife has made herself ready, has a lot in it about unity. Has a lot in it about unity. We know that the church is the bride. We know that we are the body of Christ. Brethren, let's examine our role individually in pursuing this goal, this elusive goal of unity. What is our specific role within the body of Christ, individually? Back to verse 7 here. Some of the key characteristics of this bride that Jesus is returning to marry at his return are, number one, if you note carefully, it's singular. It's not the Lamb's returning to his brides, plural. It's to his bride, singular. Let that sink in. That implies some kind of unity, doesn't it? The other key thing about this unified bride that Jesus is returning to, again, in verse 7, it says that she has made herself ready. She's made herself ready. What does that mean? It means this wasn't a reactive situation. Things didn't happen to the bride that made her ready. That would be reactive. External events acting on the bride made the bride ready. Unified the bride. It doesn't say that, does it? It says she has made herself ready. What does that mean? It means there's some proactive expectation here. Jesus is returning to a singular, proactive, unified bride. Again, the question, what is my role, what is your role in pursuing within the body of Christ unity? This most elusive goal that's known to mankind. What's our role? Because you see, brethren, if it starts with you and me, if it starts at the individual level, it will permeate and spread person to person. Healing relationships. That's what life's about. It's about relationships. It's about relationships with our God and relationships with each other. The very Ten Commandments that we all live by talk about our relationship with God, the first four, and our relationship with others, the next six. If we focus on relationships upwards and relationships outwards, and on healing those relationships, we'll be individually pursuing the goal of unity. And we'll be doing our part in getting ready, in getting the bride ready. Now, before I go any further, I just want to make really clear here. I'm not here trying to make a big case for, well, the churches have to come together under one banner and be one church, and everyone has to join this one particular organization. I'm not saying that. So please put that out of your mind. That's not what we're talking about here. You know, this topic of unity, obviously, is a big topic. It's a massive topic, and it's complicated. There's a lot of complications in it. What we're hoping to do this afternoon here is to talk through some of the key issues and hopefully spur some thinking about what we can do individually. Because what's really important is, should we be passive towards unity, or should we be active in trying to pursue it? It's so easy to become passive towards it. It's so easy to just throw up our hands and say, oh, we tried this for so long. It's so elusive. We can't do anything. All we can do is pray about it. Well, prayer is very important, yes, but what else can we do? You know, the bride has made herself ready. What's that imply? Is there more that we can do? That's what we really want to think about. And it really, again, comes down to individually, personally, what can I, Derek Strauss, what can Derek do this week to promote unity? That's what we really want to try and focus on. Brethren, we all lament disunity, don't we? We lament it. It's caused so much stress in all of our lives, if you think about it. And I'm not talking about just, you know, within the church. I'm talking about, you know, within our neighborhoods, within our country. The lack of unity is a horrible thing. We all lament it. All human beings really want to have unity. Can you think of someone who doesn't want unity? Satan. Satan hates unity. And anyone who's under Satan's sway hates unity. But everyone else wants it. Everyone else wants unity. The question is, what should we do? What should we do? Certainly prayer is key. We have to pray. We have to draw close to God. We have to look at, are we causing disunity individually? Are any of us doing that? Is every word, every action, every thought, every interaction, every relationship that we have, are we promoting unity? Or are we creating situations of disunity? That's key, certainly. It reminds me, though, of some research that I did a few years ago. I was looking at some of the indigenous tribes in Africa, and specifically looking at South Africa. And I came across a tribe called the Korana tribe. It's K-O-R-A-N-A. Sometimes it's the Gorana tribe with a G as opposed to a K in the front. Gorana or Korana. It has nothing to do with the Islamic Quran, by the way. It's nothing to do with that. Just so happens to sound similar. But the Gorana, let's go with the G just to avoid the confusion here. The Gorana tribe, they broke away from the Khoikhoi group, which was a large group that had migrated down to the southern part of South Africa over the years. And their first chief, the chief of this particular tribe, his name was Gora. And so the tribe was kind of named after him, Gora and the Gorana tribe. So that must have done something to his ego a little bit, you know. This is my tribe. And the history behind it was that he had had disagreements with the Khoikhoi, with the chiefs of the Khoikhoi. And so he broke away. He divided away from them. He splintered away from them. He had arguments with them. He had disunity with them. And he set up his tribe. Now, direct translation of Gorena means the real thing. The real thing. You see, the Khoikhoi weren't the real thing. His tribe, he was the real thing, right? They weren't the real thing. So this was a splintering away, a disunity that occurred amongst them. Question was, how long did that last? How long was the Gorena tribe intact? Not long. History shows it broke in two pretty rapidly. And you had the great Gorena and the little Gorena. Those two tribes emerged from the Gorena tribe. You see, that whole thinking of divisiveness and argumentativeness and division, that spirit had permeated through to other people in the tribe. So they said, we were going to splinter away as well. We're going to divide. We're going to have disunity. So you ended up with the great Gorena and the little Gorena. And guess what happened to them? They splintered again. And what happened to the splinter groups? They splintered again. And the splintering continued and continued and continued. And guess what happened to the real thing? The Gorena tribe that had broken away from the Khoikhoi. They disappeared. They disappeared. Remember what we said. Who hates unity? Satan. What would Satan like to do to God's people? Splinter, 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 divide, 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 splinter, 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 disappear. Great plan to the evil one. That's what he wants. One day in the resurrection, it's going to be interesting to talk to Chief Gora and to say, hey, what do you think happened to your offspring and to your tribe? And he's going to suddenly realize, well, maybe division, divisiveness and disunity wasn't a terribly good idea. And maybe he'll realize at that point, well, my prayer is that he will realize at that point that it was Satan-inspired. And that the opposite way of doing things is actually the better way. The way of unity is a better way. And it needs to be pursued from an individual level outwards. Because then it permeates through everyone that you come into contact with. It permeates outwards. Well, when it comes to unity and disunity, another word comes up immediately to mind, doesn't it? The word is conflict. Conflict. You see, Gora was having conflict with the Khoikhoi, the leaders of the Khoikhoi. And then his underlings had conflict with each other, and they had conflicts and conflicts and conflicts. And no one managed those conflicts. They just allowed them to run their course. Well, a conflict that's not managed leads to disunity. So conflicts need management. They need to be managed. Now, I want to draw a distinction between two terms here. There's conflict resolution and there's conflict management. Two different things. Conflict resolution says we would reduce, eliminate, or terminate all forms and types of conflict. That's the goal of conflict resolution, to wipe out all types of conflict or difference of opinion. That was what resolution tends to conjure up. Whereas, on the contrary, conflict management recognizes that all human beings are different. We've all got different perspectives. And that's actually pretty good, because it leads to lively debate, it leads to innovation, it leads to new ways of thinking about things, it leads to, you know, great teamwork, if it's managed in the right way. A variety of perspectives makes a fantastic team. And great things can be achieved by a team that has a lot of variety in it, a lot of different perspectives being brought to the table. Some of the most fun I've had in my own professional lifetime has been when I've had a diverse set of people on my team, all with different ideas, and we've had an opportunity to talk about our ideas productively together and to brainstorm new ways of doing things, better ways, improved ways of doing things, and given us opportunities to fundamentally question some of our assumptions that we've made, and the assumptions that we've made have led us in the wrong direction. So we were able to question them and say, that assumption's completely wrong. There's another whole huge opportunity here that we weren't seeing because we were making the wrong assumption. So, you know, do you think God knows the fact that we're all different? Do you think he designed us that way? I think he did. I think he loves variety. You just look at creation, the variety in creation. Do you think the pinnacle of his creation, humanity, he wouldn't design in the same way with lots of different people, lots of different perspectives that could all be brought together in really a rich set of discussions and ideas and dialogue, certainly based firmly on the principles of the Ten Commandments in God's way, but so many opportunities beyond that to think creatively. God's a creator. His family is a creator. And we're built to be a part of that family of creators. So conflict resolution in terms of, you know, wiping out differences doesn't really fit. Conflict management does fit with that, because it says, let's minimize the negative outcomes of conflict. Let's make it not conflict, but let's make it lively debate. Lively debate. Let's promote the positive outcomes of differences of ideas and opinions. And let's use it to fundamentally improve our learning. Let's learn. Let's learn. And remember what it says in the Bible. It says we've got to increase in knowledge, doesn't it? It says increase in knowledge and grace. How are we going to increase in knowledge if we don't accept the fact that there are going to be differences of ideas and we can learn to work together to understand each other's perspectives? So properly managed conflict increases learning. You know, that word conflict has such a negative meaning. It's almost like, let's replace it with something else. Let's replace conflict with differences. Properly managed differences, different perspectives, different ideas. Properly managed can increase learning. Especially if we're humble. If we're humble about it, you know, the problem becomes when we enter into dialogue or discussions from a proud perspective and we say, I know everything. You know nothing. And it's my way or the highway. If we are humble, it's a completely different situation that we're going to be in. So it's really about trying to find the win-win solution. It's not a win-lose. It's not my way or the highway. I win, you lose. It's not about that. It's we both should win. We should both be winning. That's what we should aim for. So you know, there's been a lot of studies done in terms of, you know, conflict between people over the years. There's library books full of studies and research that's gone into it, and they all come out by saying that there are three ways to handle conflict. One is lose-lose. You get into such a fight that both sides really lose. The other is win-lose. I win, you lose, because my way is right and your way is wrong. And the other one is win-win. And essentially, the way people have studied this topic has pointed towards win-win solutions as the thing that we should really strive for. Because that builds what? Unity. Lose-lose doesn't build unity. You all go each other, you know, in your own directions. Win-lose doesn't build unity. It builds resentment. There's no unity in a win-lose. But a win-win, that builds unity. That builds unity. Now, there's an article in UCG's magazine in December 2005 called Win-Win, Who Says There Has to Be a Loser? So this is December 2005, and this is in the Vertical Thought magazine. And so I'm gonna quote a couple of key pieces out of that article, because I really think it gets to the core of this issue in a very clear way. And remember, what we're really talking about here is, what can an individual do? What can Derek do differently today and tomorrow and every day going forward in terms of promoting unity? What is my role in the body of Christ to promote unity? So here we go. This is, again, that article called Win-Win, Who Says There Has to Be a Loser? Dawn and Pam were both good basketball players, good enough to make the varsity team in their sophomore year. And they were good friends until Dawn started hitting 4 or 5 shots a game and getting more attention. Whether consciously or unconsciously, Pam became resentful and stopped passing to Dawn. So here they are, they're both good friends. The one starts getting a lot of attention because of her prowess on the basketball arena, and the other one is resentful and stops passing the ball to her. Sometimes it seems life's all about winners and losers in sports, business, reality TV, and even school. Sean Covey, the author of The 7 Habits of Highly Effective Teens, that is teenagers, it was a book written in 1998, he talked about the forced curve grading policy in his business school that demanded 10% of each class would fail. Our competitive world influences us to think in strange ways, Sean Covey says, that this dual-style mentality is like two friends being chased by a bear. When one turns to the other and says, I just realized I didn't need to outrun the bear, I only need to outrun you. But even in movies, sports, school, and cutthroat business practices, we tend to glorify winners and demean losers. That's not the way it has to be in the most important things in life. Sean Covey and his father, who's probably a bit more well-known to most of us, Stephen Covey, talk about a different way of thinking. They call solving a problem so that it satisfies all the parties win-win. Win-win thinking. Sean Covey compares life to an all-you-can-eat buffet. No one has to go hungry. No one has to be a loser. Back to our story of the two girls, Dawn and Pam. What about them? Sean Covey relates the story as Dawn shared it with him. She said, "One night after playing a terrible game in which Pam kept the ball from me most of the game, I was as mad as I've ever been. I spent many hours talking with my dad, going over everything and expressing my anger towards my friend turned enemy, Pam. After a long discussion, my dad told me the best thing he could think of would be to give the ball to her every time you get it. Give it to her. Every time. I thought it was the most stupid suggestion he'd ever given me. The next game came quickly, and I was determined to beat Pam at her own game. I planned and plotted and came out with a mission to ruin her game. On my first possession of the ball, I heard my dad above the crowd, 'Give her the ball!' I hesitated 1 second, and then I did what I knew was right. Pam was shocked, but not too shocked to sink the basket. Dawn felt good and kept it up through the game, only shooting if the play called for her to shoot or if she was wide open. We won that game, and in the games that followed, Pam began to pass me the ball as much as I passed her the ball. Win-win. In all our relationships in life, and what is life but relationships? In all our relationships in life, we really want everyone to win, don't we? We do. We want everyone to win. When our family, our friends, our co-workers and classmates are involved in some way, we want them to win. It doesn't mean that we lose. In fact, it makes it more likely that we'll win too. Just think of the benefits of having these great relationships with all of these people. Don't you like to wake up to a day when you're interacting with everyone and it's all positive relationships? Doesn't that put you on a high? Win-win thinking is an application of the golden rule. Let's turn over to Matthew 7. Matthew 7, verse 12. Matthew 7, verse 12. Whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them. Whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them. Do you want people to listen to your point of view, to your opinion? Do you want people to hear you out when you have a difference of opinion about something? I mean, as trivial as which way to put the toilet paper. Just hear me out. Just hear me out. The reason I want it this way around is because of this. Okay, well, okay. Now let me hear you out. All right, let's come to a decision after we've heard each other out. Let's do that here. That's win-win thinking. Let's listen to each other. Let's listen to each other. It's the golden rule. The Apostle Paul also discussed this principle in Philippians 2 and verse 3. If you want to turn over there, Philippians 2 and verse 3, he says, "Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself or herself." So, you want to do unto others as you would have them do unto you, but you also really want to make sure that you've got this humility. The humility is key. Win-win thinking is so important in all aspects of life. I mean, in business, it's absolutely key. And of course, there's been tons of studies done there. There's a group called the Mediation Center of the Pacific. And it states that studies suggest that 30 to 40% of a manager's daily activities are devoted to dealing with some form of interpersonal conflict. Just think about that. 30 to 40% of the time of manager is trying to sort out the mess that's going on underneath them, where people can't manage conflict, where they can't get sorted out themselves. Where they say, you've got to come in and sort everything out, you know? It's like, oh, really? I've got lots of other things I've got to do in my time. I don't have 40% to spend trying to fix your squabbles. You need to fix your squabbles, you know, really. That investment of time makes it very important to turn win-lose into win-win thinking. Leadership expert Warren Bennis says, leaders do not avoid, repress, or deny conflict, but they rather see it as an opportunity. Differences are opportunities. They're actually things to get excited about in a positive way. Isn't that so different from the way that we've all been kind of trained and the way Satan has, you know, misled us? He hates diversity. He hates, you know, unity. He's figured out a way of making it just the worst thing. Getting back to Warren Bennis, he says, you know, that leaders see conflict and differences as an opportunity. Once everyone has come to see it that way, they can exchange combative posture for a creative stance. So instead of, oh, there's a difference, we got to go like this, it's like, okay, chill, take a deep breath, let's put a smile on your face, and think about this as a creative opportunity. This is a creative opportunity. And why is that important? What enables you to do that? What enables you to do that is because you don't feel threatened. That's the problem so often, is the thing that makes us go like this is fear. Oh, they're going to do something terrible, which is against what I believe and the way that I see things. It's terrible. I've got to fight or flight. I've got to run or I've got to fight this. Fight or flight's horrible. And that's so much a part of how we naturally are as humans. But it's not the solution, because it's based on fear. And what should we be based on? The way we live, not fear, but faith. So the Bible's got interesting examples of win-win thinking as well. You know, in 1 Samuel 25, I'm not going to turn to read the whole thing. You know, you could certainly read it. Verses 4 through 13, but I'll just summarize it here briefly. Samuel 25, 4 through 13. David had already been anointed king, but he was still on the run because Saul was still crazy, just out of his mind. And while a fugitive, David and his men had actually been protecting the flocks of a rich rancher by the name of Nabal. And so at this particular point, you know, David and his men had come in, they were tired, they politely asked if the rich man would be willing to share some food with them. And the rich man rudely refused. And when David heard this, he was angry. So he went into fight mode. The scene was set for a deadly win-lose, because David's men would have made really quick work of Nabal and his people. You know, David already had his band of, you know, brave men around him. And you know how they were. We've got lots of evidence of how cutthroat they were and how brave as well. They would just march into the face of hell, you know, as far as their mindsets were. But so where did the change came? So that was a win-lose shaping up to be a really ugly win-lose. Where did the win-win come in? Well, it came in because Abigail, Nabal's wife, stepped in. And I've got to hand it to you. You ladies, you know a lot more about this than men do. Very often, you know, when it comes to a more peaceful way of thinking about things, I think that you're blessed with a lot of more perception than often we are. But anyway, Abigail intervenes and presents a very sensible win-win plan. And David's men and Nabal's household were both satisfied. They were both okay with it. But of course, if you read on a little bit later, it didn't end that well for Nabal. He fell ill and he died, but that's a completely different story. But, you know, it turned from a win-lose to a win-win. Another example is found in Moses' leadership of the Israelites. Moses was overworking. All the Israelites were lined up outside his door. Kind of makes me think of that study where 30 to 40% of a manager's daily activities are devoted to dealing with some form of interpersonal conflict. Moses was spending way more than 40%. He was spending more than 100% of his time. He was exhausted at the end of the day. All this interpersonal conflict. Lined up outside his tent. He stole my sheep. Oh, he looked at this. He's touching me. Like kids in the back of the car. He's touching me. You know. Moses was overworked. And he was losing and the people were losing. They weren't able to get enough attention from him. Timeously. He was swamped. And his father-in-law brainstormed a possible solution. Moses wisely listened and applied the plan to give him helpers. And the people got advice and assistance that they were needing. That was a win-win. It was a creative idea that was put forward. It was brainstormed out there. And the assumption that Moses had was, I have to do everything. Well, no. When his father-in-law said, actually, do you really have to do everything? Let's look at that assumption again. How about this? And he came up with a creative idea, and the change was phenomenal. It was a win-win for Moses. It was a win-win for the people. Now, of course, there are times when you can't win. No matter how hard you pursue winning for everyone, someone on the other side wants to win and wants you to lose. What do you do in situations like that? Well, when the other person isn't interested in a win-win solution and is only wanting to make you lose, the thing to remember is that ultimately God wins and so does his people. We like to think of it in this way. Denise and I have discussed this one, and I'm sure you have as well, many times over. And one of the things that we love to think about in these situations is that, you know, God says to us, don't judge. And he says, I'm the judge. I, God the Father, I'm the judge. And we know that Jesus Christ is in the courtroom, you know, pleading on our behalf to the judge. God's the judge. But you know what every judge has? You know, you can go into any court anywhere. A judge has a room set aside, which is the evidence room. And in that evidence room is all the evidence. The judge has the evidence. So when you're in a situation and you're striving for a win-win, but the other party wants you to lose and they want to be the only ones to win, instead of feeling like, oh, this is just a failure, it's, you know, I'm getting all upset about it and being down, just remember the judge has a room called the evidence room, and he's got all the evidence about this relationship, all of it, and he's the only one that's qualified to judge it, and we've got to leave it in his hands. But that's not where we should start. We shouldn't be starting from a point of just resigning and saying, we're going to be passive about this relationship. We're not going to try and get a win-win. We're not going to put forth the effort to try and get that win. We shouldn't start there. That's where we should end up if the other person will not come to the party and pursue a win-win with us. That's the final resort, is to say, okay, God's got this. God's got this. So, conflict management then, again, going back to the Mediation Center of the Pacific and some of the key points that they make, what they say is, and they provide seven key points that people should focus on. The first one is get the facts. So it encourages both parties in a relationship to put the facts out on the table. And what this point reminds me of is a very successful technique that was employed in South Africa. Most of you will know that after the apartheid years, when there was a white government, and after Nelson Mandela was released from prison and brought out to run the country, that he instituted a thing called the Truth and Reconciliation Committee or Council, I think it was called, the Truth and Reconciliation Council. And the aims of that council were actually really good. It was all about getting the facts, putting the facts out in the open. And people who had grievances could come into that and say, I want a hearing. And they would get the other party to the grievance into the room, and they would put the facts out on the table and just admit the facts. Admit stuff happened in the past, wrongs were done, people were hurt by it. Let's all agree that that happened, but it's in the past and we're putting it behind us. Really noble way of starting out to build unity. And that's certainly one big thing that Mandela did, was he focused on building the nation. And he did an amazing job, actually, during the time that he was in power, of doing that, building unity. And the Truth and Reconciliation Council started in the right direction. Unfortunately, as all things with human beings, it didn't achieve its full aims. And we know why that is, don't we? Because God's Spirit is the missing ingredient. Human beings have got lots of great ideas about managing conflict. But unless God's Spirit is in it, and we're looking to God and the power of His Holy Spirit to make it happen, we don't have a snowball's hope in the hot place of being successful. We don't have. It's impossible. It's not going to happen. So, you know, if you look back through history, it's full of good intentions, but not many terribly amazing successes in situations where people haven't been relying on God to make it all come together. Let's see if we're at 2 hours yet. No, not yet. Okay, we've got a little bit more time. So the first point then that this group says is get the facts. Revisit what happened in the past, put it on the table. No accusations, just what are the facts? These are the facts. These were the parties involved. This is what was said. This is who was hurt by it. This is, etc. Those are the facts. Now, let's put those behind us. Let's work in the present and the future. How are we going to work together in the future? So that's the first thing. Second thing is, well, actually, sorry, that is the second thing. Focused on the present and the future, not the past. Because if you get stuck in the past, you're either a victim, and usually that's what it is. You've got a victim mentality. And that will never, you'll never reach reconciliation if that's your mindset. Your mindset is, I'm a victim. you're never ever going to get to a point of unity. You'll always be walking around feeling like, you know, you've been owed. You owed something by someone who's done you wrong. The third one is break down the problem into smaller parts and find mutually beneficial agreements on these step by step. Because so often, these things are big and complicated. And the way to do it is to really break it into pieces and take one little piece and say, let's try and fix that one piece. Let's try and get a win-win around that one piece. And then we can take the next piece, and the next piece, and the next piece. So it's a step-by-step process. For each of those little pieces, brainstorm for possible solutions, accepting ideas from all sides. A lot of the people that have studied and researched this type of technique, they say, this is the difference between dialogue and discussion. Dialogue is simply brainstorming, talking about stuff, talking about your feelings, your ideas, your emotions, putting that all out on the table, getting all the ideas listed out. That's dialogue. And it's non-threatening. Then you move into the next step, which is discussing it. Okay, now, out of all of those great creative ideas and innovative ideas about how to move forward and to do better so that we can all win out of this, we need to understand each other's perspective on them and to reach some kind of conclusion. There we get into discussion as opposed to dialogue. And a lot of these people that have studied this say it's very important to draw distinction between those two when you're having your interactions with people, to say, okay, I don't want to go into discussion yet. I just want to stay in dialogue. Let's stay in dialogue. And make sure we've done a thorough job of that before we move into discussion phase. Because that allows you to find common ground. That's the next step. Find the common ground. The sixth step, Stephen Covey talks about seeking first to understand the other person and then to be understood. Seek first to understand their point of view and then secondarily seek to be understood. Now, what do human beings typically do? No, you've got to understand what I'm thinking. It's my point of view. You've got to understand my point of view. And that's all that we're concerned about. Well, what about the other person? Covey says, you start by saying, I'm seeking to understand your point of view. Please help me understand your point of view. That's the starting point. And once you've spent time, and that's one thing about this approach, brethren, it takes time. It takes time, but it's worth the investment. Unity is worth the investment. Seeking to understand and then to be understood. This requires what Covey calls empathetic listening. And this is how he describes it. He says, you listen with your ears, but you also, and more importantly, listen with your eyes and your heart. Listen with your ears, your eyes, and your heart to the other person's point of view and sincerely try to understand where they're coming from. Seek to understand what they're saying. These six steps lead to the final step, the seventh step, which Covey calls synergy. And what he says this is happens when you get creative cooperation and everyone is working creatively together and the results are phenomenal. So, brethren, there's a lot that we can learn from this whole way of thinking about managing conflict, managing differences in opinion, managing different perspectives. Everyone has a different perspective, And it's because of mental models or worldviews that we've built up in our lives. It's things that have happened to us from childhood. We've all got different perspectives on things. Denise and I mean, if we see something happen, I'll see one thing and she'll see something completely different. The same thing, we'll have two different perspectives about an event that's just happened. Why is that? Well, because we're two human beings. We're completely different. Even after how many years of marriage? 40-something? We still, you know, we'll still see things differently. And what I'm trying to learn to do is to seek to understand before I want to make her understand what I've seen. To help me understand what you've just seen. Because that's not what I saw. There's a lot that we can learn about that, brethren, and you know, to permeate that outwards in the way that we behave to everyone around us. To our family, to our spouses, to our kids, to our neighbors, to our brethren in the church, to brethren in other church groups, to, you know, who is there that's out there in your network of relationships that you have an opportunity, a creative opportunity, to go to and heal the relationship? Who is there? Now, I would guess, you know, you all have already handled all of those things in your life, so you probably don't need it as much as Denise and I do, but just in case, you might have one or two people somewhere in your network that you've still got some kind of a disagreement going on with. Maybe now's a good time. When has the world needed unity more than now? I can't think of a time. And as it gets closer to the end, as it gets closer to the return of Jesus Christ, as it gets closer to that time when he comes back to the one bride who has made herself ready, it's urgent, brethren. It's really urgent for us to all start really thinking about who is out there in our network of relationships that we need to really pursue peace with, that we really need to pursue a win-win relationship with. We really need to sit down with, eyeball to eyeball, and talk stuff out and heal relationships. If it happens with each of us, it will permeate outwards. We can't wait for someone else or something else to make it happen. You know, I don't know about you, but I've heard all sorts of excuses over the years that people have used on this topic. You know, the excuses have run from, you know, things like, let me see, I scribbled a couple of them down here. There's nothing you can do about it. Have you heard that before? People talking about a conflict. And you've been, you know, spilling your heart out there about how you're struggling with a conflict. And they say, oh, there's nothing you can do about it. Is that, that's an assumption, but is that true? Is that really true? All you can do is pray. Well, prayer is absolutely key, yes. Prayer is absolutely key at all times when we're trying to solve any problem of any description. But is that literally all you can do? You just pray and you're passive about everything else. Is that really true? Is that a valid assumption? Does God want a bunch of passive Christians? Is the bride of Christ passive? Did she become united, the single bride, through a passive lifestyle? No, she prepared herself. She got ready. Another term that people often use is, oh, just leave it alone. Time heals all things. Come on. Time heals all things. No, you leave it alone, what happens? It becomes a root of bitterness, creates more division. Time doesn't heal all things. That's a wrong assumption, if ever there was one. Another assumption people have is events in the end time will force us to get together. I'm sure you've heard that a million times, right? Events will force us to get together. Is that what Revelation is talking about when it says the bride has made herself ready? It doesn't say the bride was forced to make herself ready by events. It says she was proactive. She made herself ready. You know, I've even heard people say, oh, you know, all this division that we have, it's okay. Maybe it's even God's will that we should be, you know, divided. Come on. Is that, where do you see that here? I'm sorry, I can't see that. I don't understand. Anyway, I see I'm nearly at my 2-hour time limit here. So let me wrap up. Brethren, the question really comes down to, you know, should we be active or passive when it comes to unity? Should we be active or passive? And bottom line, it starts with you and me. Let me say that differently. It starts with me and you. It starts with me and you. That's where it starts, at the individual level. Responsibility doesn't belong to anyone else but me and you. The responsibility for unity. Second key point, it's about relationships. Life is about relationships. Relationships with God, relationships with fellow man. Third key point, the time for unity is now.